This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we go. As Robin just called it off the air, it's Tuesdays with Bob.
Tuesdays with Bob. We killed the opening monologue already.
We got the Duggars to talk about today. We got some Rex Herrmann to talk about today. We're going to start with the Duggars. A man allegedly confessed before a lawyer was anywhere near him. The state of Florida has felony charges ready. The state of Arkansas has its own case building separately. And a defense attorney handling it just told the media his client wants to be treated fairly. Fair is a fine goal. But what the audience wants to know is what a defense actually looks like when the evidence appears, like when you maybe admitted to this on a phone call and it's stacked against you before the first hearing even starts. Joining us to help us break this down, it's Tuesdays with Bob. Bob Motti, defense attorney. Host of the podcast.
Tuesdays with Bob.
Defense Rights. We'll make a jingle for you. It's Tuesdays with Bob.
Yeah. What about Bob?
Let's start here with the Duggars. This is not going to be an easy one to walk into out of the gate. If in fact he did allegedly confess over the phone to Joseph, Dad's having this conversation with Joseph, and Joseph's saying, "Yeah, I did it, but I'm asking for forgiveness." Okay, it's there once done, and then once with an officer on the line. How damning is that going into a case if you're trying to defend somebody?
Pretty damning, T.
And it's funny, Bob, because normally I'm always waiting for the reverse angle. You know, it doesn't really count, you know, and you don't really know them, and it was coerced, you know, but when Bob said, it's not good.
Yeah, dude, no, this is not a good situation. The bigger problem from them, you know, I think we talked about last week a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you can potentially attack on the over here, you know, mm-hmm. when he makes the call. But in terms of the confession to a non-law enforcement, like you can't come at him with Mirandizing. Fourth Amendment isn't a thing because private citizens can't violate your Fourth Amendment. That's the government. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's the problem with it from the perspective of trying to attack the confessions, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? So, I mean, look, again, defense attorneying isn't scumbaggery, slippery, trying mm-hmm. to get guilty people off. You're trying to make sure that your client gets a fair trial.
Right.
You're trying to make sure that the cops did their job on the up and up. Same with the prosecutor. And you're trying to make sure that your client understands his rights or her rights. And if you do all those things and they have the evidence, they're going to be convicted if they don't take a plea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, and that's where this thing really lay. I think because we all are in true crime and we're covering active cases, it becomes kind of pushed to the side the concept that really the reality of the situation is that 90%+ of cases are pled out.
Sure.
Like, it's very rare for things to go to trial. So, and when you have evidence like this, I mean, if Duggar walked into our office, first of all, and I know we're going to get to the next question, but you know, which I'll wait. I'm usually slipping into the next questions in an answer. I'm going to try to do better, Tony.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, hard, because I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, go
but
for it.
Look, you know, I'm sitting down with my client. I'm hearing, you know, his version. In this case, I'm like, okay, did you talk to anybody? It's always one of the first three questions I ask. Did you talk to the cops? Did you make a statement? Okay, what? What did you say? I can't remember. Well, try. Because, you know, you're all I have until I get discovery, you know. And for my purposes, it doesn't really matter on an initial consult. I'm just trying to give them an understanding what the charges are, what the potential penalties are. And, you know, without having the discovery, I don't know the full story yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm kind of beholden to my client, whatever they're telling me. And, you know, I take it with a grain of salt. I understand that most of my clients come in and say, I didn't do this shit. And I'm like, okay, you know, so that question of whether or not they talk to anybody is an important one. And then, you know, I really do press them to try to get as much as I can from them on what they said and to who it was made to, that statement. matters quite a bit, as it does here. But, you know, I mean, they'll try to attack the over here, I'm sure.
Sure.
You know, because, like, the approach is you're not pleading out immediately, right? You've got to get the discovery. You're not doing the job. You're just pleading, like, you're screwed, dude. Like, sorry, you made the statement. You might as well plead you out right away. I'm right. sure there's attorneys out there that do that, but they're not very good attorneys. So yeah. you got to wait till the discovery comes in. You look at it. You say, all right, look, you know, I've looked at it. It looks like they went and got this warrant. It looks like they're basing it on the CAC interview. And they've got enough to get this thing in. This thing's not going to get suppressed. I'm not going to file frivolous motions just to file it. There's got to be grounds for me to try to attack it. And if that's not the case, then we're looking at it. We're going through the rest of the evidence. And ultimately, you know, in a situation like this, I consider the confessions or the statements just to be corroborative.
Yeah.
Because ultimately the victim's going to testify.
Yeah.
So this isn't a situation where you've just got a young victim testifying. You now have the alleged perpetrator admitting to it on two different occasions, once in an over here and then once to an individual, a private citizen. So it's tough, man.
Yeah. So Bob, I got a really gross question, and I apologize for anyone.
I'm leaving.
Watch your wording. We're on YouTube.
I am. That's why I'm going to take my time and try to frame it right. And it's only because I didn't work these cases inside the bureau, and I don't know the law much better, hugely much better than I do. I'm curious about this. Because we covered so much of Epstein stuff, and I read Ginny's book, and also we cover cases like Maddie Soto, and you remove the murder aspect of that, but just what Stephen Stearns did to her. And then I read the charges that Joseph's accused of. We have overclothing. Is there a difference in the law between overclothing accusatory, doing horrendous things to children, and no clothing? I know it's a granular thing, but I'm just curious whether they might be able to get off on something or lessen something because of that, as I just don't know the law on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is. And it, like, what it boils down to, like, just simply put, is it's a different level of felony. Yeah.
Is it?
So, yeah. Like, if there's penetration of, you know,
that's the more crash way I wanted to. Yeah. I was curious
about. Yeah. I mean, but that, I mean, that's actually the legal term.
Right.
But that, you know, that changes the game. You know,
because the penalty of this seems still was extremely steep, which I loved seeing. I was just wondering if it could get even steeper if we discover more. I guess that's what I was getting at.
Yes, it can get steeper.
Is anyone surprised that that Joseph just flat out came out and said this on the phone call with the dad? I mean, that to me, I thought was, I don't know, I'm kind of surprised and I'm kind of not. I guess you kind of got to look at it from the perspective of where Joseph might have been at that moment in time, where he's conditioned, where most things get handled insularly within the Duggar, you know, cult. And then things don't necessarily reach the law. Do you think he had zero sense in him that there might be an officer on the other line hearing this when he's repeating it again for a second time, or was he just that completely clueless? And if he's that clueless, I'm wondering why he might have been that clueless. Was this a person that he trusted to a degree that that he wouldn't have contemplated that would bring the law after him?
I mean, I would have to think so.
Yeah,
I would have to think so. I gave an example of an overhear of one of my clients back in the day. And, you know, I mean, it was the baby mama, you know, when the outcry happened, baby mama was obviously furious and upset and immediately went to law enforcement. And they said, okay, at this point, we've got a very, very young child still, but the allegations are coming from 7 years previous. We're going to want more. You know, because at the end of the day, if they're going to take it to trial and you've got the child victim is really your best evidence, you're going to try to get more if you're law enforcement. And typically this is what they'll do. You know, they'll say, all right, well, we're going to ask for an overhear warrant. And you're going to have to talk to him, and you've got to get, you've got to try to get him to admit it on the phone call. So, I mean, really they're employing that person as an agent, you know, which is why they have to go get the warrant, you know, so, and it's important for the cases typically.
Yeah.
Well, so you want, so I would assume that this wasn't a stranger. You know, I'm assuming that this is someone that felt, you know, he felt at least comfortable enough, because that's a big thing to tell somebody.
But you know what I mean? And Tony, to your point, you know, we talked about this the other day. He is so, they are so, and I'm going to use the word groomed into this religion. Remember that big word we were using yesterday? By admitting, you get restoration. As long as you're talking to someone who he feels can restore himself, so you confess and you're restored. Restoration means so much more to them than innocent, it seems, because of that religion compared to law. I mean, it's really pretty profound. And Bob, I'm curious, have you seen any other group or cult that seems to elevate their cult law above actual legal law as much as this group seems to be?
I mean, yeah, I've seen, obviously, I think every kind of cult that's been exposed criminally, like in the last 15, 20 years, you see that all the time, right? I mean, it's, they just, and I don't know if they rely on this concept that they're, you know, they're outside of the boundaries of the law because it's religion, you know, and, and I think that they're kind of confusing what, you know, the freedom of religion clause means, you know, and that's what are like you don't get to turn around and say, okay, well, you know, our religion allows murder, but, you know, unfortunately for them, there's a statute that predates that religion, because the concept of the Constitution is that the government can't make any law that infringes upon that right. Okay. So, like, meaning it's going to be, it's ex post facto. So they start a religion, and, you know, one of the things they do is, you know, they drink Kool-Aid standing on their head, waiting for the mothership to land. And, you know, the government's like, you know what? I cannot stand watching people drinking Kool-Aid, like, standing on their head, shit's coming out of their nose. It's disgusting.
It's weird.
We're going to pass some legislation strictly banning that. Like, that kind of thing, you've got an argument, you know, a constitutional argument. But you know, obviously, SA statutes are in place and have been for a very long time. You're not going to be able to escape being tried under a state or federal law based on religion, for the most part, you know, and it's like you used to see it more. Oddly enough, I had a really, when I was in law school all those many years ago, every year we like, so the 1Ls, the first years, would all, every one of them would have to prepare an appellate brief, and then we'd do oral arguments. It was a competition. And then ultimately, you know, it was like bracket play. You'd make it in the final two. So our interesting fact pattern was that it was a child whose parents were, oh God, what is the religion? They don't celebrate holidays and birthdays. Starts with an M.
Jehovah's Witness?
Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. My neighbors like that growing up.
Okay, so one of the other tenets of that religion is that they can't have other people's blood. It's like, like, so blood transfusions are wholly
big no-no,
rejected in their religion. And so this kid, so the fact pattern was this. Okay, you've got parents, you've got a 16-year-old kid. He's got this disease where they can cure it, where if they don't do this particular surgery, which they're going to need to transfuse blood during the surgery. If they don't do that, then he's going to lose his ability to be able to walk. It's not as severe as he's going to die. So it was clever the way that they made it, where it would just, he'd lose his ability to be able to walk.
That's all.
So that's all. Big deal, right? So like the two issues for us were mature minor doctrine. Okay. Like, was that child mature enough as a 16-year-old to make their own medical decisions. And then the other one was this tug of war between the First Amendment and the right of religion. And it's their belief, it's their firm belief. So we had to argue it out, you know, and there wasn't any, I mean, there's this case called Yoder, which is a Supreme Court case that really digs deep into the First Amendment, but it was a fascinating exercise. And it kind of gets to the heart of what I think the mindset of a lot of these cult leaders and the followers subscribe to, you know, and it's just this thing where they're living off grid, you know, they're living in their own kind of commune. They have their own set of rules. They do things differently. They don't feel as if they're a part of regular society. You know, I mean, yes, there's probably aspects of it where they incorporate because they need to make money. You know what I mean? Like money's always the thing. Money is where they.
And that's what's so interesting about these guys is that they are not. I mean, you have the Amish, which are more off grid than IBLP is.
Yeah.
And yet they seem so. Even though they keep having these examples in the same family of Josh and now Joseph, that they fear that umbrella of that protection of their religion more than they fear the law, which has actually bit them in the ass a lot more than anything else has. And yet they still keep coming back to it. It's really mind bending.
I think that their thing is, you know, God's going to make it okay. You know, if they're operating in according to their tenets under the word of God, as they understand it to be, and you know, what you always get with these cult leaders is that, you know, they got the bat phone to God. Right.
Yeah.
You know, God's communicating with them directly. And so, you know, I mean, if you get people to the point where they're brainwashed enough or their faith is so deep in that person that they actually do believe that there's some kind of Messiah, you know, and that they do believe that this person is communicating directly with God. I mean, how do you overcome that in terms of you've got to unbrainwash them? You've got to.
I mean, it's almost like a toxic glass half full mentality, where it's beyond just like, well, let's try and make the positive out of this, because some things there's just no positive to be had, and Jim Bob's letter to Joseph in prison was basically toxic positivity.
Yeah.
You've done some very horrible things, or however he worded it.
Choices.
But he's going to use it, but you're going to be able to minister to those behind bars and spread the word. It's like, what? Let me get ministered to by the guy that was doing these things allegedly to a kid. Like, let me just, this is the person I want to hear the word of the Lord from. But they seem to not understand the context that sticks to them and how vile and disgusting they look. They always view themselves as pure as long as they've made their peace. It doesn't matter that nobody's made peace with them. As long as they've made their peace with God, well, then everybody else should just be, you know, they should just be in fine light going forward. And that's the real sickness, I think, of cults and of this specific family.
See, here's where it's fascinating to me. And here was where I would love to see just massive psychological examinations taking place with these cult leaders.
Yeah.
To where you can figure out, I mean, are they either psychotic in that they think that they're communicating with God? I mean, do they actually think that that is happening, or is it all just a big ruse?
Well, I mean, there's plenty of religions that are not this extreme that think they're communicating with God and, you know, and walk around. Yeah.
Let me clarify. I'm not talking about praying. I'm talking about back and forth. All right.
That's only Lori Daybell. Lori Daybell believed that. And Chad.
A lot of them do.
But this group, you know, I haven't read anything that said that this group believed that. They just have an interpretation of the Bible that what they did was, again, I'm not the expert, from what I keep consuming every day of this of my life so far, is they've handpicked aspects of it that allowed the founder to rationalize his control he wanted to have over people for top cover of his own abhorrent behavior. I've seen this in other things, whether it's law or politics. Nation states do the same thing, mm-hmm. where you'll cherry pick stuff that is a doctrine that people will adopt in mass, like religion, and they'll cherry pick their stuff to rationalize your own abhorrent behavior, and you form people and groups around it. And that's what's happened here. And then you keep perpetuating that, but as common sense as it seems to us, when you are that needy of acceptance and being valued, and then you get in that collective group mentality, I'm telling you, I mean, yeah. if anyone wants to see the power of a group mentality, you can do it on YouTube. You go to YouTube and you go to Candid Camera Elevator Experiment. And you can see the power of the group mentality, social pressure, and they get the old Candid Camera with Alan Fun. Those of us that are old remember this. You would get three or four people in an elevator, and if one person turns to the back,
right,
everyone else is start turning around, beard like, right. because you just want to conform to that group. And so that's what happens in groups like this, where they have this belief system that restoration, all you have to do is confess. And you confess, and again, the wording, they don't have words like sexual sins. They call them moral failures.
Yeah.
Wording is everything, right?
It is. I mean, you'll notice the blow.
You'll notice that same sort of approach. IBLP is them, but I was just watching, and there's a new doc coming out on Netflix about the FLDS and Bateman. But I was watching the earlier one that it's like part two to it, basically. I forget what it's called. It's like, you know, pray, obey, something of that nature. But they operate the same sort of way, where you get these people that come out of this cult at whatever teenage year or 20 something. They don't have words to describe what happened to them. That's right. Part of how they hold everything in. That's part of how they people can't talk about it. They don't have the words to do it. They don't exist in their vernacular. And if you purposely keep people away from being able to describe what has been done to you, and the only things that exist are some sort of godly term or some sort of thing that tampers it down, doesn't make it quite as bad, or even in some cases, look at Warren Jeffs, it's like godliness. They're convincing people this is what the Lord wants, is for me to do these horrible things to you as a child. You then get people defining it very differently depending on how you framed it.
It is no mystery. Religion. And Marx said it many, 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 many years ago. It's an opiate of the people. It's used to control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
flat out. And that's not to say that people that have faith, good on ya. You know, sure. I'm all about that. That's a great thing. Yeah. But in terms of the mechanics of religion, mm-hmm. you know, Tony, to that thing that you're talking about, you simply have to make it, that it's a rule within that religion.
Yeah.
You know, if certain things are happening, well, you're not going to say, oh, well, we're going to keep quiet because we don't want to get in trouble with law enforcement. You're framing it in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Right.
It's coming down from the hand of God.
Yeah.
That this is what we've been taught to do. Now, the rest of society might not accept this as normal, but mm-hmm. you know, this is what we know. And if me as your fearless leader, this came down straight from the big guy.
Especially when you assimilate, because it's not even that you know, I'm talking to God, like we were talking earlier. They identify like the leader, Gothard, with God. They identify the father of the family with God. Like they're on that level with God. Right. So if it's as good as coming from God, basically, if dad says it or the leader of the cult says it, that's just as good as God. It doesn't even have to come down. It's like if they decided it, if this came to his brain, well, it came to him from God. So it's just as good. And that's how they're able to kind of make this even less less ridiculous than it already is.
And we forgot, I'm sorry, because the one aspect that we forgot to talk about in this, in the last couple sessions on this and today too, that I really want to emphasize, this religion, this IBLP, they victim blame the women for enticing the men.
Mm-hmm.
That was, so we haven't even covered that aspect of it yet. So no matter if a male has a moral failing, they blame the woman for being too enticing. That's why I have to wear the clothing they do. So that's how they get around. Again, we're talking about that reframing and not having definitions for things. So when these, when the poor men are susceptible and have a moral failing, they try to identify the woman that made it happen and they chastise her.
Yeah, well, that's
a lot of religion.
I got news for you, Robin. That's not just in religion, man. I mean,
I know.
Sadly, in society, where women are you know, who are victims, who are then blamed because of their the clothing that they wore, they were asking for it. It's it's sick. You know, sick. I mean, like that concept is disgusting. You know, but like I want to jump back. That thing that you were talking about, Tony.
Yeah.
I mean, that Messiah complex. Whether it was I had a dream. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter in terms of reaching that level where you are seen as the Messiah at the level that same level, maybe like one notch below God. It's because at some point they've said that they've had communication with the Lord. That has happened at some point. They may not be talking about, he may not be saying, oh, well, you know, God gave me a call last night and this is what he said. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like that.
It's
to kind of establish yourself as that you're the one, you're the chosen one, you have to have had some kind of communication.
They make it very palatable for their followers to believe. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on what's going on with Joseph Duggar. There's more to talk about in this case. Joseph Duggar isn't the only one who needs a lawyer. His wife has her own charges, her own attorney, no custody of her children right now. Recorded jailhouse calls are already in prosecutors' hands, and they're all over the internet. Family members are giving statements to the press from every direction, and the question nobody in this family seems to be asking is whether all of that talking, emailing, and public positioning is building a defense or building the prosecution's case for them. Bob, I want to go to you on this one. In theory, we're just... You know, speaking theoretically, if this were to have taken place, and I'm not saying it has, and I'm not saying anyone would do this, but let's just say that a totally different situation, totally different case, an imaginary case, if you will, theoretically. Let's just say the victim is a family that's very close to said family, and let's say that family wanted to go to law enforcement a while ago about this, but then were coercively controlled by somebody in the family of the abuser to maybe not do that. To maybe maybe there's reasons. Maybe there's threats. Maybe their housing is threatened to be taken away. Maybe it is taken away. Maybe certain other things are taken away. Money, church, all sorts of all theoretically, of course.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying this is happening.
The way they're used to living, the custom to living a certain way, and that's all going to go away.
And if you're to, and there's a certain person with a certain amount of power and a certain amount of levers that is basically saying, okay, you go to law enforcement, you turn in my kid, here's what's going to happen. Pretty effed up.
I'm not
saying this is happening in this case. Just, it's a parable. It's a parable is what it is. It's the parable of exposure. If someone were to be doing it, if someone were to be trying to actively control someone to not go to law enforcement to report this as a crime, could that person be charged with a crime for actively doing that?
Well, I mean, if they violated the law, they violated the law. That coercive control aspect of it becomes part of the defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you're talking about Kendra and the charges that she picked up, which were, I think, child endangerment, imprisonment, you know, like she's got those things hanging over her head. She cannot use the same attorney, right? They have to have, even though there's spousal privilege there, the problem is that there's still an inherent conflict. Like you can't have two defendants that are co-defendants because, you know, our rules of ethics dictate that, look, you zealously represent your client and that's it. And
I guess I'm more questioning not Kendra and not Joseph, but if there's somebody,
like a person, like anybody,
deeper within the family,
right? The family is there. If there's
someone within the family that has a lot of control over the purse strings over the victims and them speaking out about
this. Give me more in your hypothetical. What crime are they charged with? Kendra was specifically, she had. Yeah.
Witness
you know,
tampering.
Dominion she had dominion over the property.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Kendra at all, actually. I'm
trying to get to you. You have to pick a crime that one of these people that would be what they could charge
preventing about. Someone from reporting child S abuse or encouraging or incentivizing a reason not to, or basically coercively controlling, saying, yeah, you report this. If the consequence of that action is going to be, you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose that, because I control these things over you. And if you do this, I'm going to take this away. The person who says, I'm going to take this away for you doing the right thing and legally, responsibly reporting the crime, that sort of level of coercive control is my question. It's not about Kendra. It's about someone else, theoretically, in the family that's going to hold that over someone who wants to report.
What you're saying, it takes a little bit more legal analysis to try to figure out what you charge them with, because if they're not a mandatory reporter, it gets more difficult to figure out what to charge them with, because you're almost looking at, actions that they took. Internal, like actus reus type situations, mm-hmm. where they helped facilitate the abuse in some way. And then again, what you're talking about in terms of the coercive control, that becomes the defense. It's that part of the evaluation from law enforcement and the prosecutors isn't part of what they're looking at in terms of what can we charge them with? Because that's always the puzzle. In these cases, especially in these cult cases, with trying to figure out how can we go at the members?
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to go and cut off the heads.
Yeah.
Because what they've done is evident, and they have an understanding, law enforcement in particular and the prosecutor both have an understanding that they're controlling the situation through this coercive control, under the guise of religion. And, so to get one of the members, it's tougher, man. It really is. I mean, it's not to say that it can't be done, but you're going to need to have somebody really flip to talk about what these members are doing. Because, I mean, if you're violating the law, ignorance of the law is no defense.
Yeah.
Like if you're essentially the one that is making things possible, even though mm-hmm. you're not the one committing the act, there's certainly crimes that you could be charged as a co-conspirator, in those types of situations. So, but just kind of like being there and knowing that it's happening and you've got this threat from the higher ups, like, hey, if you go forward, a lot of bad shit's going to happen.
Like just theoretically speaking, like if let's say there may be an email or something or some sort of communication that would exist on the record of, yes, this is horrible. This is very disturbing that this happened. We'd like to handle it amongst ourselves. We think that that's the best way we should do it within our faith or umbrella system or whatever. And let's do it that way. And then let's say the other person says, no, I think we're going to go to the police on this one too. And they're like, well, that's unfortunate. You want to do that. And if you do that, then we're going to have to withdraw these sort of things that we're giving you or helping you with, or our relationship is going to be in question. We're going to have to change this or that about it because we don't agree with you going to law enforcement. Not going to law enforcement actually is breaking the law if you're aware of these sort of abuses happening. But the person discouraging you from doing it, that's the part where it's like, that is breaking the law to a certain extent, but to what extent, how do you prove it? I guess that's the critical part here, because we're digging deeper into this case. That may be another chapter. We don't know yet. We're still digging, and there's a lot of digging that's going on. And I see people in the comments already like, yep, we know what you're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about. But it is it's an interesting lever of control, and it would be par for the course if anything like that were to be going on here, considering a track record of let's cover up the abuse and not let TLC know until they've greenlit our show.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, mandatory reporting violations are going to be the biggest thing.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, mandatory reporters, you know, you've got obstruction of justice charges is kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Look, the reality of that situation, T, is that they don't really have an interest in going after the members per se. Like what they want to do is they want to flip the members. Yeah. So they have to have that threat of charging them with something, which, you know, if these people are smart, you know, they're not going into any meeting with any law enforcement without an attorney, because everyone should always have an attorney anytime they're talking to law enforcement. Anyone.
Are you surprised Joseph didn't know that? Are you surprised?
Yeah. I mean, dude.
I don't think they, you know, and Tony, I totally get your point as well about that threat that's there from removing the benefactor of Jim Bob from your life and the proceeds from the TLC stuff. But all the language I've ever seen him use, they never have to say that. It all comes down to that analogy that has all that's going to happen if you take these actions is, I don't know what's going to happen. You're going to fall outside the umbrella of protection.
Essentially, yeah. You never have to really truly say it.
And that's a hard thing to then make that jump.
It's hard to litigate it.
Yeah, it really is. Because what does that umbrella mean? Well, it just means that you're under the Lord's protection. Yeah. You see what I mean? So they have groomed everyone into understanding what that means without ever having to say it. They really did a good job of inoculating themselves.
They know the gray areas and they know statute of limitations pretty well.
I think they do.
And how to play them very well.
Horrendously so.
Let's talk about the charges that are against Kendra, the home inspection that came out, and it turns out allegedly the door locks were reversed. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this a little bit. Is it something they can argue as being pure and simple? The kids are yelling, they're having tantrums, and they'll open the door if we have the locks on the inward part of the door. So we lock them in there and let them scream it out. I'm trying to think of like the shit that people are going to come up with on this. Yeah. But if we're to look at a more, I guess, nefarious thing on that, keeping the kids contained in one room and not letting them out, there's a lot of reasons, I guess, if you're a horrible human being, you could be doing that, because you may not want the children to walk in on something else that may be going on with another child in another room. I don't know. That's what comes to my mind, possibly. I don't know. But how severe, I guess, are these charges against Kendra? I know Jim Bob has said it's ridiculous that she's charged with this, but they did their due diligence. Thank God they went in because of the charges in Florida. In Arkansas, it automatically triggered that inspection. How serious can this get? Is this just a big nothing burger, or is this something that could lead to something much larger, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, Bob?
No, I mean, false imprisonment and child endangerment are pretty serious charges.
Sure,
man.
Sure.
I mean, they carry some heavy-duty time. You know, I like, from the perspective, again, of law enforcement, you're looking at, like, okay, so who was the perpetrator of the essay? That's a different set of charges. Who's the person who helped facilitate it? That's Kendra. You know, because false imprisonment in Arkansas really requires that the confinement, number one, is unlawful, and two, that it's without consent. All right. And, you know, to your argument saying, well, you know, look, this is a parenting practice. The kids were out of control. When they were just off the rocker, completely unbehaving or not behaving properly, and we had to lock them in the room because they just we couldn't stop them from being so difficult. I mean, ultimately, the challenge is going to be the context in which they argue it. You know, were the locks on the outside? You know, who had access to the keys? Were the children ever actually locked in? You know, those are going to be facts that come out on cross on whether this, you know, because it's like it reminds me of, obviously, without the cult portion of it, but the kid who was kept in the the cage or the box. Mm-hmm. Remember, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I do too. A decade or something like that. It was crazy. The guy had built the room and they were saying it was because the kid was so out of control and we kept the kid in there. And the, you know, I mean, they went down because they were arguing that it was, you know, parenting practice. We just couldn't control this kid. We were afraid that he was going to kill us. You know, the kid was out of control. So, I mean, ultimately, if you're asking whether or not these are serious charges, they are.
Yeah.
But it all flows directly from her husband's case.
You sure.
Know sure. So, and that's going to be an interesting kind of, like, are they going to try them separately? I would assume that defense counsel will argue that they do need to be tried separately. You know, but are they going to be able to get the bad acts in of, you know, the other case in order to be able to try her? And I think the answer to that question is yes. I think that they will if they do try them separately, because it's hard without giving the context of what was going on in that house to win the case. Mm-hmm. If you're the state, if you can't argue, look, I understand that they're saying it was parenting practice, but this is what was really going on.
Sure.
Okay, like these rooms that were locked. And again, this goes back to your parable, your hypothetical, wherein you need members to flip.
Yeah.
You need them to say, okay, well, we know what was going on in those rooms. One of those kids was my kid. And my kid told me what was going on in that room because I asked.
Let me ask you this. They have Kendra and Joseph have three kids, or four kids, actually, three of which should be able to speak. One's an infant or three. The other one's 5, 6, and 7 in age. After this went down, is there an automatic interview of the children? Is there an automatic forensic interview with a child psychologist or something with their own kids to make sure there's nothing horrible going on in that house with their own children? Is that something that should be done, could be done, needs to be done, has been done? How does that sort of lever work? Because I'm going to guess you might get some interesting stories out of these children. Granted, they are children, but they're also going to be the most pure and the least trained to toe the line of the Duggarville, or pulling a Duggar. And I'm curious as to really how those levers work, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, typically, you know, you get those child advocacy interviews. We call it like CAC here, based on an outcry. So, yeah. I like, it's a sticky situation, man.
Should we have an outcry, like public outcry?
It's got to be an outcry from the victim, or somebody that is aware of the abuse.
Yeah.
Again, a mandatory reporter.
Sure.
And again, this goes back to your hypo.
Yeah.
You know, if you have any member that's aware of any abuse that was taking place with their kids, then, I mean, you've got enough smoke there to get an interview going. You have to kind of think of it in the sense that, I mean, there has to be some probable cause. Right. And the reason they use child advocacy centers is because law enforcement isn't trained.
Yeah.
You know, like your typical cop, because you have to handle.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt.
Target incredibly traumatic. Right. You know, so like typically you have people that are conducting those interviews with law enforcement on the other side of the glass, listening a lot of times with an earpiece with the person who's performing the interview with the child, and they're saying, all right, ask them this, ask them this, ask them this. It's challenging. There has to be some kind of probable cause that there was abuse to that child in order to be able to get to the point where you're going to have. So that
would the charges against people, Joe, would the charges against Joe trigger that though?
It depends on who the victims are.
Yeah.
It depends on who the victims are. Like if there's allegations that he was doing this to his own children, then yes, of course.
What about if it was allegations doing it to someone?
In-laws.
In-law. Just in theory. In theory.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably close enough.
And the fact that he said it was not pure intent. He didn't go into it with pure intent. That was his own words. Not pure intent. So you got the dad, Joseph, who's admitting to having not pure intent with a 9-year-old.
What does that mean? What does not pure intent mean?
I don't know. That's how he described it. Not pure intent. I guess, you know, we can take with it what
remember,
we will.
Remember, they don't have the word sexual assault. They don't have the word sexual assault in their religious vocabulary.
True. So I think it's immoral intent.
Immoral intent is their way of saying they're doing horrendous things to children.
So it was not pure intent.
And also, and on top of that,
pure intent, that would seem to be an absolute confession. Right? Well, like from their perspective, if you're putting in the framework of their religion, mm-hmm. if you have, you know, if the moral intent was pure, meaning it was in line with the tenets of our religion, in their mind, that's not a crime. If he's coming out and saying it wasn't mm-hmm. pure intent, well, then he understands even under the tenets of his religion, it was a crime. Like, I don't know why that guy would have said that.
So if he's showing a propensity for impure intent with people under the age of 10, and he happens to have four of them in his house that are under the age of 10. And I'm not saying he's done anything with his own kids, but I'm saying if he's already admitted to doing this with another person's kid, isn't that enough to kind of trigger this of like,
And also you have an uncle who's in jail for doing it inside the house. Would that give probable cause, because the Uncle Josh was doing it to his siblings? Is that enough to trigger probable cause?
I would think so. I'd make the argument.
Yeah, me too.
You know what I mean? It's like at some point, I'll take my shot with a judge any day of the week. You know, it's so insidious.
It's easy to say no, but you don't get no if you ask.
So different than any other type of case because of that religion element of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But again, going back to the initial segment we did, which if you didn't watch it, you should go back and watch it. But, you know, I mean, the intent in terms of pursuant to their religion matters not in the eyes of the law.
Right.
You know, the intent in terms of the mens rea as to our law, that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. You know, if your intent was to SA a child, well, you violated the law in the country that you live in, and you're bound to answer for it. So, you know, it's like it's interesting, man. I mean, what you really need in these types of situations, I know I keep saying it because it's true. You need people coming forward. You need people caving. You need people flipping. You have to, you know, because you need the information because they're so closed mouthed about
it. Well, there's 19 of them out there that can do that now. So,
and on a side note, you know, and the thing that popped in my head last night, and I'm sorry, it's slightly aside from what we're talking about, but I was really thinking about this a lot. We've seen this in other organizations. So just take the propensity of what we're seeing in this 19 children family. You have two now, one's convicted, the other's accused of doing horrendous things to children. How does this organization, IBLP, filter the predators that they're now attracting into their organization? Think about that. They have a formation of an organization that allows these things to happen. I say allow. It's a strong word. That makes excuses for these things happening, and they help them go away. Who do you think that attracts? What kind of predators do you think that attracts into organizations like this without a filter? I mean, that blew my mind as well to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrifying thought. Yeah. You know, I mean, if I had these proclivities and I'm out there as a creep, and I kind of come to find out, well, look, this kind of thing is allowable. I found a home, man.
There's so many of them. That's why we see so much abuse and so many people being taken advantage, not only in this way, but financially, horribly, because it's a honeypot for a predator. It's like, yeah, I hit totally. The jackpot. There's all these people willing to believe whatever bullshit I spout out.
And all I gotta do is own it.
Yeah, exactly. All I gotta do is say it, and I'm sorry. Oh, you keep giving me your money and do whatever. Great. I mean, it's time and time again. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. There's one more case we're going to talk about here today, because there's some big stuff that's about to go down with it. Seven women allegedly killed over a span of roughly 7 years, a case that went cold for over a decade, a suspect who maintained his innocence for nearly 3 years behind bars. And now, reportedly, it's time to say, it's me. Rex Zimmerman is expected to do a guilty plea. It doesn't just close a legal chapter. It may be opening up a whole different kind of wound for families who were bracing for a trial, preparing to sit in that courtroom and hear every detail laid bare. What does it mean when the fight just stops? Bob Mata, criminal defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, is with us. Bob, well, we're expecting to hear Rex Zimmerman plea on the 8th.
Tomorrow
or today, yeah, depending on when you're watching this, or yesterday or years ago, whenever you're watching this. 10 years ago, he did this. 2026, the 8th of April is supposedly the date. Why now?
Look, when this happens in a case, and this thing has been going for nearly 3 years, you know, it's not a single conversation that takes place. Mm-hmm. It's a process, you know, that builds up over months. And, you know, the reality is that the defense in this particular case had some pretty hefty challenges as to the DNA evidence. You know, I mean, they, mm-hmm, they put up a pretty hellacious fight, you know, to where a lot of people were really nervous about that DNA evidence being excluded. When the judge denies those motions and the DNA evidence is coming in, you know, you're sitting there as the attorney, you're like, okay, well, we're in deep, deep shit. Like, you know, and that's what you're telling your client. You're saying, look, we tried to fight it on this end in terms of Fourth Amendment violations, and we didn't prevail on it. It's coming in. The reality is that, you know, you're going to get convicted on this. You know, I mean, there is very, very, a very minute chance that the state's going to screw up to the extent where a jury's going to find you not guilty. You're talking about 7 victims. You're talking about, they have the hard drive, which they also tried to keep excluded, which is coming in, which wasn't just like a, I mean, it was the do and don't do, you know, it was literally right, his brain on paper talking about, okay, I did this and I don't want to do that again, because that could be the caught.
How to be the Gilgo Beach killer for dummies, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so T, I mean, like in terms of Huerman reaching the conclusion that I might as well just plead it out is interesting in the sense that New York does not have the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the part that's kind of fascinating to me. Like with Huerman, it's a different set of circumstances than it was with Koberger. With Koberger, right, as soon as Bill Thompson, who was the prosecutor in that case, took the death penalty off the table as a carrot to get Koberger to bite, mm-hmm, and Koberger did, that made sense. You know, mm-hmm, Koberger chose his life over going to trial, you know, and I'm sure he was having a lot of conversations with Ann Taylor about the strength of the evidence in that case. And, you know, Ann Taylor, I'm sure, was pragmatic and saying, look, you know, they have some powerful evidence. We've got these theories of, you know, you're a stargazer and you like to drive at night, and whether or not a jury's going to buy that, you know, when coincidentally 4 kids lost their lives at the same time that you were out driving and stargazing, and you know, your phone wasn't hooked up and then it was, and then you're driving, you know, I mean, like all those things that were out there, you know, there's a car that's driving by in the neighborhood that looks exactly like your car. I mean, you know, I mean, all those things you're talking to your client about. And so Koberger, I think that was kind of a no-brainer. With Huerman, where they didn't have, because, you know, I've had this conversation recently about Huerman, like the state, I'd be stunned if this is a plea, meaning, mm-hmm, there's, because like a plea agreement between the state and Huerman, mm-hmm, because Ray Tierney is not offering that guy anything.
Like, that's what I'm curious about. Yeah, like what's the carrot?
Right, you know what I'm saying? Like, so, and I want to make that distinction for people. There's a difference between a change of plea, which the defendant, that is a constitutional right. You have the right to either plead guilty or not guilty. Mm-hmm. That is in the express purview of the defendant. The lawyer doesn't get to decide that. The judge doesn't get to decide it. It's all Huerman, whether or not he wants to, though, because he obviously originally pled not guilty, mm-hmm, when he was getting arraigned, and now he's decided to change his mind. I'm going to plead guilty. I'm going to avoid trial. And it's a fascinating thing, because I just don't think, like I'm trying to understand why at this point. Like usually in these cases,
yeah,
serial killer cases, you roll the dice.
Let me ask you this, and I'm wondering if this is the carrot on the stick for whatever reason. I don't know why. Maybe there's very damning evidence here. We don't know the answer to this. We're expecting, you know, Wednesday that it's going to be a plea or an admitting of guilt here for 7 murders. It's going to be 8, allegedly.
Right, that just broke. Yep.
Karen Vergata, Fire Island, 1996. He's going to be charged with that, and he's expected to plead guilty to that. So it'll be 8 counts that he's going to be pleading to. It was.
I saw that story.
Yeah, it's brand new. Just came out.
Who's getting that information? Theoretically, only 2 people on the planet know that.
News 12 Long Island is where I'm reading it from.
I understand that, but the source is really not relevant to me. Right. What I'm trying to figure out is how does somebody know that? Because Huerman's lawyer knows it, and Huerman knows it, unless somebody's got a line to Huerman.
Because I don't know,
if his lawyer's spilling, that's a big problem.
Does that change anything?
I'm wondering. I'm assuming they're well aware, Huerman's team, that he was going to be charged with this before any of the public knew, and I'm wondering if that played into the decision to plead this, or if this is something that once they realized, oh, he's going to plead to this, let's tack another one on while we're at it. And, you know, he's going to plead to these anyhow. Why don't we just add this one to the mix? How did this go on behind the curtain, Bob?
Wait, is the story exactly? Did they charge him with the 8?
Sources, Huerman's expected to say he killed Karen Vergata, a source, at a court hearing Wednesday, sources say he will enter a guilty plea to the murders of 7 other women. Vergata's legs were found in a plastic bag in Fire Island after a disappearance in 96. Skull found 15 years later west of Tobey Beach. The terms of the plea agreement are not yet known, but there's been a talk of potential agreement for months. That's all we got. It's a very short. It's a short story.
Poorly written.
Yeah. As all news stories seem to be these days.
You can't plead to a crime you haven't been charged with. Now, like, if he wants to come in there and confess to all kinds of stuff that he hasn't been, like, unindicted crimes, then, you know, they can turn around and indict him on it.
Are they going to charge him at the same time he's pleading? I mean, is that how that works? I don't.
Like, it can't work. Yeah. Like, if he comes in and he spills.
Yeah.
Like he talks about, you know, the 7 that he's been charged with, and he adds Karen's crime in there, and then he throws like 4 more in there. Just
are we going to see like a BTK moment? I wonder.
I mean, like that's where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
Like because BTK, you know, Dennis Rader came in and just spilled.
Yeah.
You know, so but like they'll still have to go through the process. If he confesses in open court under oath, it's a pretty easy charge, right? I mean, you're then going to indict him on those as well, and then you have to do it formally. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You have to follow the legal process. It's not, you know, it's like the judge can't sentence him or find him guilty on things he hasn't been charged with. That's not how the law works. So, you know, I mean, but Tierney will run back to his office. They'll get the indictments done, or they'll put, you know, a probable cause affidavit or a, you know, whatever they use in New York, and then they'll get the things charged formally. And then once he's charged formally, then at that point, obviously he can turn around at the arraignment and just plead guilty to him without going through the whole rigmarole. You know what I'm saying? Like that would make no sense for Huerman to spill during his statement and allocution and then all of a sudden plead not guilty when they actually charge it to like that. But, you know, I mean, is Huerman like thinking with the right mind? I don't know.
I'm theorizing he's using, you know, kind of in the Dennis Rader mindset of using these other things he's committed as potential currency later on. But is there anything, because these types of people don't do things for the benefit of others. Like, I don't think he's doing this for the benefit of his family. This is serving himself. Any theories on how this is serving himself is like, what does he get out of this? What, if any, carrot does he have except the fact that he thought he was going to be convicted no matter what anyway? Let's hold what I still have as currency once I'm behind bars. Is there anything beyond that you think he's thinking?
Yeah. I mean, his ego. Sure. You know, if he's leaning into being one of the most notorious serial killers of all time, that's a huge ego thing for him.
Grandiosity,
You know what I mean? And, like, as far as I can tell, that's probably the biggest driving motivator for him. Because I mean, there's nothing under the law. It doesn't benefit him any way in the law. So you've got to go and look at it from a personal perspective. And, you know, if he wants to be able to openly talk about things and, you know, write a book, I mean, you know, I mean, some of these guys are absolute egomaniacs.
True.
You know, I mean, beyond being just a narcissist, but that like, and it feeds their ego. Like, are they, you see it sometimes with the mentality after the fact of some school shooters, you know, that, right. that really it was their desire was not necessarily to kill, but was the notoriety that came along with it because their minds are warped. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, we can't understand it as normal functioning human beings, but their mind doesn't work like ours does. It's different. They operate in a different world than we do mentally. And psychologically,
he's getting up there in age. There's only so much time if he wants to. And I'm saying this, you know, from his mindset, if he wants to cash in on what he's done, not necessarily monetarily, but emotionally, mentally, because that attention is what feeds him. Yeah. Of people's disgust with what he's done. He's only got so many years left to do that.
Yeah.
So now is as good a time as ever, I guess, if you're Rex Heuermann.
If it's going to go down that way. So
yeah.
Like, I don't know, Robin or one of you guys, or maybe Todd threw up a creative Chaosify's comment and they had said, it's about getting to keep his secrets. You know, sure, he'll admit to doing it, but the details, that's his little secret. Excuse me. I mean, the story also broke late last week that the judge is going to try to hold his feet to the fire during allocution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, meaning that he's going to have an expectation of Heuermann giving details.
Yeah.
And I just don't see a world in which a judge can force that,
right.
You know, because there's that Fifth Amendment wall, mm-hmm. You know, like, again, this all, it all interplays with one another, you know,
how would that go in
and admit to Karen, then he's spilling his guts.
But Bob, know? Like what would happen if they went in? Okay. He says he's going to plead and he's going to have to own up to it. Not just yes, like Koberger got away with, but actually has to explain his shit. Maybe not to the extent the BTK did, but enough. And then he doesn't. Then is the plea not accepted? Is it like you didn't follow through on your end as we're doing?
The way it normally goes, T, is the state gives it on a plea.
Mm-hmm.
The state gives their factual basis.
Okay.
Where they lay out, if this had gone to trial, this is all the evidence we would have admitted. And then the judge is like, okay, I accept your factual basis. I believe that you've shown enough to... Mm-hmm. You know, convince me that he's committed these crimes. I'll accept either the plea deal or the plea. So again, I don't know how they do it in New York, but I would be stunned if the state isn't going to be putting forth their factual basis of the crimes.
Yeah.
Like, which again leaves Koberger, or I'm sorry, Heuermann, with the ability to simply go up and do what Koberger did.
Yeah,
and just say yes. You know what they said is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Which. Again, I mean, I'm seeing varying opinions and frankly, none of them matter in terms of what the victims want.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the victims' families.
Yeah.
You know, it's a major logical leap to just assume that they want to hear all the horrific details.
I
don't know that that's true. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, but I've seen people saying it, you know, and like that story that comes out about the judge forcing Heuermann or trying to force him, that Fifth Amendment wall, man.
Yeah.
Like the judge is creating a potential like immediate nightmare on a like an absolute basis of constitutional violation if he tries to force Heuermann to spill his guts. And if he does, he then exposes himself to additional uncharged crimes. It's a problem. So I just don't think the judge is going to do that. I've seen like my friend Mark Bettero, who's a New York attorney. He's like, oh yeah, the judge is going to really hold his feet to the fire. I'm like, and I asked him on Twitter. I'm like, how is he going to do that? Like I'm not getting sucked into the hype of this. Like, mm-hmm. there's human lives that were lost. Yeah. This isn't a game. Yeah. You know, it's like I get that the public wants to know all the details. Well, tough shit.
But I mean, and is that an appropriate place to be doing it? Because yes, some may look and go, see, he's being exposed and he's telling his shit. And to us human beings who don't do this sort of thing, we would be horrified and ashamed and feeling it would be the worst moment of our lives to have to admit these things out in the open. For someone like Huerman or a BTK, that's this spotlight grand moment that he's reliving over and over. It might be even better than the murder themselves, the attention that they're getting. So we got to look at it from their perspective. Is that feeding the ego? Is that feeding the monster that is Rex Huerman by saying this shit out loud? If it is, shut him the fuck up. Don't let him talk.
Right.
Don't
exactly.
let him get his moment.
You're gonna collapse to the terrorist and give yeah. what he wants, or you like, know, it's like, yeah. you know, because that's what I'm saying. Trying to figure out what his motive behind pleading and changing his plea. Is to me, if I'm Ray Tierney, I'm trying to think of like, okay, you know, like, why is this guy doing this all of a sudden? You know, yeah, we got him dead to rights. I get it from the legal side of it. But, you know, I mean, in a case where the death penalty is not on the table, these guys usually roll the dice.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, it's unusual that, and again, I'm playing the role of Ray Tierney, why he'd be doing this. And he'd have to land on the same conclusion that we have.
Sure.
Which is that it is for his ego, and that he wants to get out there and spew his horrific tale because, you know, it cements him as the monster that he is. And that's what he's always wanted to be viewed as.
Because
you know,
his only currency he's left with at this point in life is information. Right. And if he holds all the information he has without going to trial, then he still has control of his only currency he has left in life. And he's going to trickle that out as he feels he needs to in order to get what he wants from behind bars to service himself in any way possible, to service that ego, to service that vanity, that sense of grandiosity and look, I'm better than this person. Whatever it is that he wants to service, he is only left with the information currency. And I think that's why he's holding it.
This man obviously operates... on control of information. We know that much. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Go ahead and do that and press subscribe wherever you're listening to podcasts right now so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases we follow for you right here. Also, check out Bob's podcast channel, Defense Diaries, on YouTube and wherever you get podcasts.
Love
Defense Diaries. Search it, press subscribe, and check out Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available right now wherever you get your books.
And tell a million of your friends.
Yeah, Russ Huerman never read that book.
Send him an autographed copy.
You know, I got to really do that one of these days. I got to send it all to people we cover.
And Baby Steps. Send him Baby Steps.
Baby Steps. Baby Steps in a bookstore.
Baby Steps to the commissary. All right. Until next time, for everyone, for Robin, for Bob, for Todd, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening, and we will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.